Hello, I'm Dr. Manesh Patel, and welcome to this CME event called Balancing Act, Optimizing Anticoagulation Care in Renally Impaired Patients with Non-Valvular Atrial Fibrillation or Venous Thromboembolism. This activity is provided by CME Outfitters, a jointly accredited provider of continuing medical education for clinicians worldwide. This activity is supported by an educational grant from Bristol-Myers Squibb Pfizer Alliance. So thank you guys for joining, and again, I'm Manesh Patel, and I'm a cardiologist at Duke, and it's really actually fun to have a past colleague and a friend join me here, John Stanifer, who I'm going to hand it over to in a second, who's going to introduce himself. And I think this is going to be an important conversation because I think for both of these topics, we're bringing obviously medical perspectives, but maybe from different sort of aspects. So, John, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thank you, Manesh, for that introduction. I appreciate that, and I'm pleased to be here and looking forward to our discussion. I'm John Stanifer. I'm a clinical nephrologist. I practice full-time at Munson Healthcare in Traverse City. We run a busy dialysis unit, inpatient service, specialty hypertension clinic. So a lot of varied interest, but this has always kind of been certainly a clinical niche of mine and a real interest of mine just because of how often it comes up in our patient population. So I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah, thanks, John. I mean, I think it'll definitely be important for us to think across a lot of the benefits and risks and things that you probably think a lot about in our patients with, let's say, end-stage renal disease or worsening renal function, and then certainly hypertensive and other risk factors that obviously co-mingle or at least participate in at least AFib and some VTE. So thank you all for joining. Let's begin by reviewing our three learning objectives. After participating in this activity, learners should be able to evaluate the efficacy, safety, and appropriate dosing of anticoagulation options for renally impaired patients with atrial fibrillation and venous thromboembolism. That's our first objective. Our second objective is to integrate the findings from randomized controlled trials and real-world experience to improve the care of our patients with renal impairment and non-valvular atrial fibrillation and VTE, including our older patients. And these are many of the patients you probably see in practice, so hopefully you'll find that valuable. And our last objective is to apply shared decision-making to patient care to improve long-term adherence to anticoagulation therapy. And as we've gone on in medicine, we see more and more opportunities for us to ensure our patients both understand what's going on, can tell us their preferences, and we can come to a shared decision to hopefully personalize the evidence that we're going to go over in objective one and two so that you can actually change your overall practice. So with that being said and those three objectives, John, why don't we start with some key definitions and background to set the stage for our discussion today, specifically about, you know, how do we define kidney disease, and when we're using these terms, what do they mean?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I think this is important because you're going to hear a lot of terms today, whether it's CKD, advanced CKD, or advanced renal disease, or advanced staging of kidney disease. So I want to make sure that we're all on the same page and really have an understanding and clear definition. Chronic kidney disease, or CKD, is defined as a persistent abnormality of kidney structure or function. So one of the key things here is that it has to be persistent for greater than 3 months. So it's over time showing some type of abnormality in, like I said, the structure or function of the kidneys. And there's a lot of ways to define the way that kidney structure may be abnormally developed or some anatomical abnormality. But most commonly when we're referring to chronic kidney disease, we're really looking at two major metrics. We're looking at the estimated GFR, or creatinine clearance, by some measures, and we also measure the degree of protein in the urine, or albuminuria. When we define kidney disease, we really look at what now is really the gold standard now, or the most common measure of kidney disease, is looking at the KDIGO guidelines. And so here we have a heat map of classification of kidney disease, going from normal GFR, which would be greater than 90, with very little albuminuria. This would be considered stage one. Stage two would be a GFR kidney function between 60 and 89 milliliters per minute, and this with the presence of albuminuria. When we get into moderate to advanced stage chronic kidney disease, we're really talking about a reduction in eGFR. So at stage three, which can be classified as A or B, this would be between 30 and 59. Stage four would be 15 to 29 milliliters per minute of GFR, and stage five, which is kidney failure, is less than 15 milliliters per minute of eGFR. It's also important to note that albuminuria is an important risk factor when measuring and looking at chronic kidney disease and assessing kidney function.
Yeah, thanks. John. I think that's really important because these definitions are going to be important because we're going to be talking a lot about data. And, you know, you and along with a lot of my nephrology colleagues, you know, you've really defined well the chronic kidney disease nomenclature and this the KDIGO system, I think, aimed at trying to improve outcomes from kidney disease globally. And I think what I will say from the cardiologists and the AFib perspective that I think I'm supposed to represent some in the show is that certainly, you know, we see risk across those CKD categories we're going to talk about, whether it's EGFR and albuminuria. And then we're also starting to see risk regarding how the therapies are used or how they're cleared. And so both will be really important about which drugs we use and how we think about it for different ones. So maybe we get going on our first objective, which was to evaluate the safety, efficacy, and appropriate dosing of these therapies in patients with renal impairment. Importantly, thinking about those patients with both non-valvular AFib and venous thromboembolism. I'll speak a little bit to non-valvular AFib and then maybe kick it to you when we think a little bit about venous thromboembolism. But feel free to jump in and make sure I'm keep me honest if I'm stating something wrong or getting it sideways. It's always important to make sure everybody learning is open to getting all the information we can. So first, let me just talk about risk with atrial fibrillation. I don't think whether you're in primary care, cardiology, community health center, a kidney doctor, atrial fibrillation is unfortunately more and more prevalent, as we know. It's a disease of the aging. As we age, I tell our patients that the top part of the heart eventually gets a little stiffer, doesn't work as well, gets fibrosed. That leads to atrial fibrillation. And we know that the estimation in 2020 was that there were probably around 50 million people worldwide with atrial fibrillation. In the United States, probably around 5.5 to 6 million people. And it's important to recognize that your lifetime risk, as the population's aged, has gone up. And in some estimates, people will say, you know, 1 in 10, 1 in 12 patients over 65, 70, generally over 80 might even have atrial fibrillation at some point in their life. We do see that the prevalence of atrial fibrillation seems to be higher in white individuals. About 20% of African-American individuals will have atrial fibrillation. 30 to 40% of white individuals might have it. And it's worth recognizing that other populations, as our demographics over the next few years change with Latin American or Spanish-speaking patients or Chinese individuals, there are going to be different populations that have different risks. Importantly, the reason we care about atrial fibrillation is, of course, that it increases your risk for stroke and systemic embolism. It is associated with increased risk for death. And unfortunately, people also with this have dementia and a variety of other features. It's you know, whether atrial fibrillation is increasing your risk of CKD or CKD has a lot of the same risk factors that lead to atrial fibrillation is something I'm sure we could talk about. But in general, I think it's important to recognize the burden of atrial fibrillation that leads to often over $28 to $30 billion a year in care and costs in the United States. Now, how do we think about our patients with risk stratification? It's important to think about this historically and then now. So when we think about patients with atrial fibrillation, we've used traditionally the CHADS-VASc score, but I will remind you that when we think about the clinical trials that we might present, at that time we were actually using the CHADS-2 score. And the reason we went to the CHADS-VASc score is some of those agents, the newer agents, although the direct-acting oral anticoagulants, the DOACs, were shown to be beneficial compared to warfarin. But at the time we were studying them, you know, warfarin, I used to call it Muhammad Ali, it was undefeated in trials against anticoagulants until 15 years ago. And at that point, these DOACs started defeating warfarin. And at that point, the standard was CHADS-2 because warfarin was too risky for some of the lower CHADS patients. And so because of the intracranial hemorrhage risk and others, warfarin traditionally was used in patients that had at least two of the CHADS-2, one to two of the CHADS-2 risk factors per guidelines. Once actually these drugs were effective, we used the CHADS-2 VASc score, which is congestive heart failure, you get a point, hypertension, you get a point, age greater than 75, you get 2 points. Diabetes, you get 1 point. Stroke, prior stroke or systemic embolism, you get 2 points again. And then vascular disease, MI, PAD, age, and sex. However, I'll tell you that we've done risk scores, our own and others in different publications, where we've said one of the great things that can tell you overall patient risk is actually their EGFR or renal risk, because if you think about your calculation of EGFR, it's age, sex, body weight. And I bet the creatinine clearance is a good measure of diabetes, heart failure, and some of those other vascular measures. So in a way, I absolutely think you should be using guideline-recommended CHADS-VASc, but you should recognize that someone's EGFR is a really important risk marker too. And the recently released 2023 AHA ACC guidelines recommend that when you have a patient with atrial fibrillation, you go through this schemata of doing a risk stratification using the CHA2DS2-VASc score to determine what their risk of stroke or systemic embolism is. And understanding that those patients that have a high bleeding risk, you don't actually have to do a score for that. You can start to use some of the measures that we can talk about, although there are scores such as the Hasbled and others. The guidelines recommend that you tend to treat those patients with some of the newer agents, and I think that's important. There are other risk scores people might use, and I just mentioned a few. There's an atria risk score for bleeding. There's a orbit bleeding risk score. There's a Hasbled bleeding risk score. I actually recommend against using many of those bleed scores. Now, why do I do that? Because your default should be to treat the patient for reduced stroke or systemic embolism, remembering that in the randomized trials that we'll cover in a little bit, patients with atrial fibrillation, if they met criteria to get treated, not only did they have less stroke or systemic embolism compared to warfarin, they had less intracranial and fatal bleeding, and the mortality looked better in some of those trials compared to warfarin. So your default should be to try to identify patients that you can treat, and only if there are some significant contraindications would I not be treating those patients, and we'll come back to that. That doesn't mean you shouldn't think about some of these risk calculators, because some of these things, liver disease, prior bleeding episodes, malignancy, some of those things are similar across patients that are at higher risk, but many of the CHA2DS2-VASc scores are still prevalent. So I think it's important for you to recognize that this risk calculation, what we once thought was like, let's identify their risk for stroke, let's identify their risk for bleeding, and then make a decision. That's not how the trials were done. They basically identified people that were at risk for stroke, gave them the therapy, and they got a benefit. So I think it's important to think about it that way.
Yeah, it's also interesting, Manish.
You know, I wonder what you think about our renal patients. Sorry to interrupt, but I wonder what you think about for them.
Well, it's also interesting if you look at, for example, the atria bleeding risk score. It's interesting how kidney disease is kind of treated in some of these. I mean, this idea of severe renal disease being either a dialysis or a GFR of less than 30. But when you look at the atria risk score, for example, it probably doesn't give you a lot of nuance with respect to our population because they're already anemic, all of our kidney disease patients. Almost all of them have hypertension. And of course, they have the severe renal disease. So you've already accumulated six to seven points from the get-go, right? So what additional information is this really adding in that context? That's just an interesting observation that I've had in looking at the atria risk score.
Yeah, and I guess that gets to my question for you. Do you think about these patients with ESRD or CKD differently? Because you're right, they have a higher risk of bleeding. They also, unfortunately, have a higher risk of stroke, as I've highlighted, because they have all of the same risk scores that go in the CHA2DS2-VASc. And they also, unfortunately, have a higher risk of mortality, because, unfortunately, our patients with end-stage renal disease have had these risk factors for a while. So how do you think about that?
When you look at, for example, let's take the ESRD or dialysis population, and how do you even think about the stroke risk in this population? There's no question about it that this is an incredibly high-risk population, both for ischemic and hemorrhagic stroke. I mean, these patients have a 7- to 9-fold increased incidence of both ischemic and hemorrhagic strokes, and this is at baseline, right? So they have somewhere between a 5% to 7% annualized risk for stroke, even without atrial fibrillation. So when I'm starting to think about this, right, I'm thinking, well, what additional risk does the atrial fibrillation pose to the patients, right? And of course, we just understood that these patients often bleed more often. They certainly bleed more often. So this is, I think there's no doubt that this is a unique population that has a lot of nuance to it and certainly demands a lot of conversation and communication back and forth between the cardiologist and the nephrologist.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great point. So, John, how do you think about the risk for patients for venous thromboembolism?
So venous thromboembolism, let me just give you a quick overview of VTE. So this comprises both deep vein thrombosis and pulmonary embolism. This affects up to 900,000 individuals in the United States each year, leading to nearly 100,000 annual VTE-related deaths. And it is, in fact, still the most preventable cause of death in hospitalized patients. And we know, though, that the incidence will continue to rise because we have aging populations that are living longer with chronic health conditions, like we just touched on, in a major way. When you look at how age impacts the risk for venous thromboembolism, it certainly goes up for both men and women as we age, but it really dramatically starts to rise around the age of 50. So that by the time you get to about the age of 70, there are more than 600,000. The incidence of VTE in men is more than 600,000 per 100,000 person years. And in women, it's more than 500,000 instance per 100,000 person years. The role of anticoagulants in VTE is certainly well established and a very critical cornerstone of our therapy, right? This reduces the risk for not only the thrombus extension, but also importantly, the propagation of the thrombus, right? I mean, going back to the time of Virchow, we know that it's the embolism that we're really concerned about, right? So we know that treating with anticoagulation will reduce the risk of propagation of these clots, and also to an extent, the post-thrombotic syndrome that patients may experience as a direct result of the clot, with post-thrombotic syndrome being defined as some long-term effects that develop from this previous or ongoing deep vein thrombosis. This could be things like edema, chronic pain, swelling, and skin changes of the affected limb. There are some bleeding risks. You can also calculate the risk scores for bleeding related to treatment of VTE, and there are some online tools that are established for this. And essentially, this comes down to things that we've kind of already touched on, right? I mean, certainly the renal dysfunction comes into this play again, the anemia, the history of bleeding, uncontrolled hypertension, and these are all kind of things that we can put objective numbers to try to understand, well, what is the bleeding risk? But generally speaking, kind of like you touched on with AFib, right? These are patients that you're going to come into this thinking, not what's the bleeding risk, but more of, I need to treat this patient. This patient needs to be on anticoagulants. That's kind of my default zone here. And then this just kind of layers on top of that to understand how to have that conversation with the patients and say, okay, what's our surveillance strategy going to be? And that's kind of the way I would approach in this setting, right? Because it's not like you're coming into most patients, unless they have active hemorrhage, to say, well, I'm not going to treat you for your VTE.
I think that's a good, you know, thought process around how we think about their risk and the common therapies we could do. What's the safety and efficacy? Like, what's the standard of care for VTE now?
Well, let's take a look at the efficacy of DOACs versus vitamin K antagonists, for example, in VTE. So there was a well-done meta-analysis by Vanderhall in 2014, and this included five studies investigated the four major NOACs. You have rivaroxaban, dabigatran, apixaban, and edoxaban, and over 24,000 patients with acute VTE. And you see that in this, the relative risk for recurrent VTE, fatal PE, and overall mortality for the NOACs versus the VKAs were around 0.88. Now, this confidence interval did cross one, but we see that it was tending toward use of the DOACs in this situation. Importantly, on the other hand, the relative risk for major bleeding was substantially less at 0.6 when you're looking at the DOAC therapy compared with vitamin K antagonists. So yes, if you look at major bleeding, clinically relevant, non-major bleeding, non-fatal intracranial hemorrhage, or a fatal bleed, really across the map here, you see that this favors the use of DOACs for the treatment of VTE with relative risks anywhere from 0.36 to 0.76. with confidence intervals that are well below one. So there, I think no question about it, across the board for these major bleeding events, we're seeing that the safety of DOACs is very well established in comparison to warfarin.
You know, as you just highlighted, there's a sea change in that for VTE, DOACs are now probably what I'll call first line or standard of care for chronic therapy for our patients, no longer warfarin. That is also now true for non-valvular AFib. If you take the place that we were in before, which was atrial fibrillation and stroke prevention was warfarin or nothing else that was proven. We now sit in a place now 10, 12, 15 years from when these trials started to say that all four of the agents, the direct thrombin inhibitor, dabigatran, and the direct oral anticoagulants that were factor 10A inhibitors, rivaroxaban, apixaban, and edoxaban, were studied in four trials, RELY, ROCKET, ARISTOTLE, and GAGE-AF. And these studies by Christian Ruff were published in a meta-analysis in Lancet and generally show superior efficacy as a group in the prevention of stroke and systemic embolism compared to warfarin. And also importantly, as we talked about on the safety side, significantly less fatal hemorrhage across all those therapies, with some of those therapies showing reduction in all bleeding, certainly apixaban in one of the doses for edoxaban and dabigatran showed that compared to warfarin. So there's some opportunity for clinicians to be making some choices there. And in this sort of conversation and CME event, we've been talking about renal insufficiency. And so it's important to think about absorption and metabolism of our DOACs. And first, I'll just say that dabigatran is a prodrug. All the 10A inhibitors are direct acting 10 inhibitors. So dabigatran has a bioavailability that's 3 to 7%, has a prodrug, and then has to get translated into its active metabolite. And that active metabolite, unfortunately, has 80% renal clearance. And so I would often say that for me, you can be talking about some of the other DOACs, but generally as people's creatinine worsens or their estimated GFR worsens, I don't usually reach for dabigatran given this accumulation issue. It can be dialyzed, or you know, when we first started using these agents, there's a lot of conversations with our nephrology colleagues and we were worried about it, but thankfully it had less fatal bleeding and the drug is used, but maybe not as used as much in people with renal clearance. Regarding renal clearance for the other agents, I think it's important to recognize apixaban, edoxaban, and rivaroxaban all are having some renal clearance with, for apixaban, about 27% renal clearance or so, and about 35% for rivaroxaban. So similarly lower, about 50-50 for edoxaban, and we can talk about dosing and clinical outcomes. And they have, you know, obviously metabolism that requires some paying attention to CYP3A4 and other metabolites. But in general, I would say they're the standard of care. Their bioavailability is generally pretty good, and their ability to be renally cleared is less than dabigatran's probably the most, but is less than, and does have to be thought about for our patients. And there are some dose adjustments we'll go into, both in the trials and in clinical practice. But one way to maybe end the first part of our learning objective is to make sure that our recommendations for patients with VTE and AFib, even those with some end-stage renal disease or at least CKD, is to risk stratify the individual. For AFib, that's CHADS VAS score. And then for those that are at intermediate to high, and that's a CHADS VAS score 2 or greater, the recommendations generally to anticoagulate those patients. For those that are low, 0 or 1, it's a conversation with the patient and some conversation about what to do. Specifically for those patients with valvular heart disease, it's important to recognize these are all recommendations for patients with non-rheumatic valvular heart disease. The term non-valvular AF is really aimed historically based on warfarin being used in rheumatic heart disease with atrial fibrillation and then AFib, and rheumatic heart disease being specific around mitral stenosis, because that is a risk-increasing valve lesion that causes AFib to be anticoagulated and probably anticoagulated differently. And we now subsequently actually have clinical trial data in patients with rheumatic heart disease that hasn't shown that the DOACs are better than warfarin. And so for that reason, most people would say for rheumatic heart disease, you still need warfarin. Mechanical valves, you still need warfarin with atrial fibrillation. But in the others, the patients with atrial fibrillation and some level of CKD, as we've discussed, and the guidelines would say stage 3 or greater, you should be thinking about preferably the DOACs over warfarin. And stage 4 or stage 5, we should be talking a little bit about making sure using labeled doses. And then for end-stage renal disease, you know, there it's harder because it's important to recognize the DOACs were not studied in people with a estimated GFR less than 25, although some of the package labels have a recommendation, and the guidelines do, on people with a creatinine clearance less than or equal to 15 or on dialysis. There have been some PK/PD studies, and there's some thought around what to do, but we can get into that. But warfarin is at least discussed, and when DOACs are discussed, at least dose adjusting them and sometimes thinking about DOACs like apixaban, which might have some more at least PK/PD data there, people have talked about. I would be cautious across those to make a shared decision-making and patient risk decision, as you've described. But that's sort of where we are in the management of our patients with AFib and these conditions. And these kind of unique conditions include cardio-oncology, liver disease, but maybe most importantly for us, CKD. And in CKD stage 3, I think, use the agents. Those are at-risk patients for stroke. Use the DOAC agents and make sure you're dosing them correctly. Stage 4, you're right on the borderline of where some of the evidence was in randomized trials. I would still probably use it, just making sure I'm dose adjusting. End-stage renal disease, I think the first question is, you know, is there value in anticoagulating versus not in an end-stage renal disease patient? And that's about that patient's underlying risk for other issues. I'll call them other comorbidities not related to AFib. And then if I'm going to use it, you'd have to think about warfarin or dose adjusting a DOAC based on PK/PD, and some of the guidelines specifically call out drugs like apixaban there. I think you'd have to look at each of the drugs to be thinking about your patient, but certainly there's maybe a little bit more data there. John?
Well, and I think you kind of hit the nail on the head when you said shared decision-making, right? Especially into the stage five and beyond kidney disease, because I always approach it and I come to the patient. I'll say, look, here's what we're thinking. You have this risk, right? For you have AFib. We're talking about stroke prevention. There may be some bleeding considerations here. There aren't a lot of data to guide us at this level. So I'm pretty open about that. And we started a discussion. So I had a patient 2 weeks ago, 85 years old. I'd known him for a while. He'd kind of been in and out of AFib. I had this conversation with him. And it came out after just talking with him for about 5 to 10 minutes. He said, I'm a very functional 85-year-old man. I'm scared to death of having a stroke. That's the last thing in the world that I want. And I would be willing to entertain any type of risk. I said, great. There's your answer, right? Because we had about a 5-minute conversation. So that value really came, or that goal and those values of his really came out. And so that made it a lot easier. And so we decided, right, that we would use apixaban. And in that case, we dose adjusted based on the Aristotle dosing criteria, the same, right? The creatinine above a certain level, his weight and his age. And he got 2.5 milligrams of apixaban twice a day.
That's really helpful. And I think that's probably where we have to be for a lot of those patients as they get older and have worsening renal function. Let's get to the learning objective two, which was to integrate the findings from randomized trials and real-world data that we've gone over into our patients with renal dysfunction and oral and older patients, just as you described. And I think the main reason we want to talk about those individuals is because we know that they are, unfortunately, some of the most undertreated individuals, right? And so one way to think about this is since the agents came out, and I think it's important to recognize that these drugs were approved, I'll call it, in 2010 going into 2011, dabigatran, the first one, and then sort of after 2011, rivaroxaban, apixaban, and eventually edoxaban came about. But as we sit here in 2024, I'll just say that 12 to 14 years in, what I would say about this is we have increased the use of DOACs, but we've really taken some of the patients that were on warfarin and moved them to DOACs. There still remains something like 30 to 40% of patients undertreated. And when I say undertreated, I mean not getting any anticoagulant. I don't count aspirin as a treatment for atrial fibrillation, and or getting a dose that is low for what they should be getting. So undertreated meaning either not getting anything or the inappropriate dose. Now, I will say that, you know, when we think about patients with renal dysfunction and the dosing, it's important to recognize that we have Joey Harrington, one of our fellows here at the Duke Clinical Research Institute, worked with the patient-level data in a data set we're calling Combine AF, where we got the four trial leaders to put all the data into one data set, and we did what I'll call a patient-level network meta-analysis. Fancy words, we're doing a meta-analysis across four trials using some patient-level data to say, how does kidney function affect that? And when you look at these data that I think she was lucky enough to get published somewhat recently in Circulation. When you look at these data, what you find is that as renal function worsens, there's this point where your GFR around 30, 20 or so, that's where your highest risk for stroke and systemic embolism and potentially bleeding. And then as you get even worse, people get other things happening to them. Unfortunately, their risk of dying and some other things happen. And then also just to recognize in the clinical trial, we're likely identifying healthier patients that are worsening renal function than potentially patients that might not be in trials. So there is a trial bias in some of these data that you'll see. Nevertheless, what we were able to find was that using the dosing that we had, that patients who were getting the as you just highlighted, the dose appropriately using the doses based on the FDA label is important. All of the trials dosed them differently. You know, I was involved in the rivaroxaban Rocket trial, but our institution was also involved in Aristotle, and both trials tried to determine renal dosing. Up front in Rocket, we tried to dose at 15 milligrams for a creatinine clearance between, or estimated GFR between 50 and 30, I'll call it. As you said, the ABC criteria of age, body weight, and creatinine for apixaban of 2.5 was used. And what we saw in the combined data set was that there wasn't a huge risk as long as you could get people on the right dose. And if people were on the standard dose, which was the FDA-labeled standard dose, they actually did pretty well with renal dysfunction. And so I think it's important to recognize those were at high-risk patients, and it's something to think about. And I'm sure you've thought about dosing in renal patients a lot. I didn't know if you had any specific thoughts or thoughts there.
Well, I think the dosing is probably the biggest question I get from pharmacy and cardiologists and primary care doctors, and saying, how am I going to dose this medication? And I do see a fair amount of rivaroxaban being used, at least down to stage 3 or 4. Rarely would I see it in stage 5 chronic kidney disease. And, you know, again, I'm just up front with the patients. I'll say, we, as you mentioned, right, Rocket AF did not enroll, they didn't enroll patients with creatinine clearance of less than 30. We don't have clinical data necessarily to guide the dosing and use of rivaroxaban. Is mainly pharmacokinetic studies. And so I just send them back to the FDA insert, and we'll say that 15 milligrams once daily is the expected to result in the serum concentrations of rivaroxaban similar to those patients with moderate renal impairment. So I look at that, and so I usually, certainly when they're below 30, if I'm using rivaroxaban, I'm at 15 milligrams once daily. And
yeah, right.
I think, and
sorry,
I think as we'll see a little bit later,
that's probably right, yeah.
And as we'll see a little bit later, when we looked at Aristotle in a little bit more detail in the patients that got in Aristotle between 25 and 30 milliliters per minute of kidney function, that the apixaban dosing really probably should stay the same with respect to how we do it, that ABC, right, the age, body weight, and creatinine.
Yeah, thanks, John. I would make sure people watching recognize that sticking to that's important. In fact, age, body weight, and creatinine, there are some people on the borderline, and you don't want patients to bleed. And most patients don't want to bleed, and they all come into my office saying, can I take the lower dose? They all want to take the lower dose, and it's not just for anticoagulant. Can I take the lower dose of the statin? Can I get the lower dose of the beta blocker, right? So patients don't want medications. I would just caution you to make sure you use it as it was studied, because if you don't, you're maybe not actually reducing their risk of bleeding, and you might actually increase their chance to get a stroke. So being cautious about studied dosing is important. And apixaban is a great example where I actually think for a lot of those patients, 5 BID is still going to be the dose, because that's what they got in the trial. It just makes you feel uncomfortable, but that's where they're going to get the biggest bang, and it's important to recognize that's where the opportunity is.
Yeah, it's no question. I mean, even I feel that a little bit in our patients on dialysis, and somebody will come to me and say, well, I'm a little bit nervous because they're on dialysis. This is pretty extreme renal failure. Maybe it should be 2.5 twice daily. And I'll say, but that's not what Aristotle was, right? I mean, yes, they didn't include ESRD, but from what we know, we really should be sticking to that ABC criteria. And right, the other side of that coin is, are you putting them at the enhanced risk at 2.5 of bleeding without the benefit, right? without the maximal benefit, let's say, of the medication? I think that's important. Conversation in clinic yesterday with a patient, not really that advanced CKD, but a creatinine of around 1.5 to 1.6 milligrams per deciliter. It might have been 1.4 on the day of, and he'd gotten a nosebleed or two, and so he had actually dropped his dosing to 5 milligrams once daily of apixaban. And so we had to go through this whole conversation. I said, well, really, are you achieving one? The once daily is not the appropriate dosing, but even at 2.5 milligrams twice a day, are you going to achieve and realize the maximal benefit of this medication? And the answer from what we know in the trials is no, you're not. And that really, when you look at your other criteria, you need to be on 5 milligrams twice daily.
Yeah, so I think that's absolutely right. And then I'll take a moment to talk about the elderly, and then maybe ask you about the VTE patients. But, you know, there's also been a meta-analysis. We talked about the analysis we did at a combined AF, but there's also been a meta-analysis on the elderly done by a group of investigators that was, I think, published in the Geriatrics Journal. And again, those elderly defined as over 75 or less than 75. And again, thankfully, across all the trials, you see a benefit compared to warfarin. Over 75 for stroke and systemic embolism reduction. In fact, the benefit's greater if you look at just the point estimates in people over 75 compared to less than 75. And that's not surprising, because over 75, just like the CHADS2 VAS score, they're at higher risk. They're going to have more stroke systemic embolism events. Some of those are bleeding and stroke systemic embolism events. And when you have effective therapies like these newer agents, they seem to have even a bigger benefit in those people over 75. How about bleeding? There's no free lunch, right? So stroke systemic embolism seems to be better. That does include some intracranial versions. When you look at meta-analysis for bleeding, major bleeding, you start to see a few differences. Some of the people over 75, at least point estimate wise, it's not statistically significant heterogeneous, but there's some signal of heterogeneity for maybe apixaban and edoxaban having a difference compared to dabigatran and rivaroxaban. Although when we look at under 75, we still don't see that difference. So there may be a question around, are people over 75 in the clinical trials, potentially having a subgroup of a subgroup saying, do they bleed more? Now, when we looked at all patients in the DOAC trials, not just at 75, but we also looked at ICH and other values, we didn't see as big of a difference. In fact, fatal hemorrhage across all of theirs doesn't seem to be dramatically different. When we look at DOACs for patients over 90, again, I think that there are patients in those trials that were over 90, and it's valuable to see that the ICH benefit is still present. This has led a lot of people to think about a study called FRAIL-AF. And FRAIL-AF was a study that I will say is an important study. It was published in Circulation, and it was a randomized trial in people over 75 with a frailty score. We could talk about what the frailty score was, but they really randomized to switch off of warfarin to go to a DOAC. And even though the trial was carried out for 4 years and 2,600 patients, and switching from vitamin K antagonist warfarin to a NOAC in these older patients was actually associated with more bleeding complications without any change in stroke. And so a lot of people have said, see, I'm not sure I should be treating my older patients with DOACs. And I would just put a lot of caution on that conclusion. What FRAIL-AF taught us is that if somebody lives through the bleeding stress test that is initiation of warfarin and they're stable for several years and haven't had a stroke, then that's right. Changing that patient may not have a benefit. But I'm not sure that that teaches me that all of my elderly patients that I see in practice should not get a DOAC first. In fact, the randomized trials would do that. I'm going to make one more comment about some of the Beers criteria and then go on to VTE with you. The Beers criteria are criteria that have been put out by kind of traditionally a geriatrics group that says they are agents or drugs that we want to give people caution to because we think they may be putting patients at risk. Here I'll just say I'm cautious about these criteria because they're not recommendations that are based on randomized trials. I just went over the randomized trials, and I actually think the randomized trials should give you comfort across almost all of these agents, the newer agents. However, the Beers criteria do state that rivaroxaban may be harmful in elderly patients. But one of my concerns is they don't state vitamin K antagonist might be harmful in elderly patients. So it's complicated for me to hear that one of the DOACs or some of the DOACs are better than others. I'm not suggesting they couldn't be, but giving preference of them or warfarin is complicated when there's randomized trial data there. So I'm not suggesting don't dose appropriately. I'm not suggesting some of these agents might not even be better for elderly. Certainly some of these may bleed less, like apixaban, and certainly using some of those isn't a bad idea. But giving preference of some of them based on non-randomized data gives me some pause. With that, I'd be interested in what your thoughts are on venous thromboembolism, John, on sort of where are we on the treatment of those patients in the elderly and the CKD.
Yeah, and I think, you know, first it would be important to understand what are the outcomes associated with venous thromboembolism or VTE in patients with and without chronic kidney disease. And there actually have been some interesting work in this and well done article in JAMA Open Network that kind of looked at this, right? And then basically what you're seeing when you're looking at the results of this large global registry that they accessed in the 10,000 plus patients is that, you know, essentially patients with chronic kidney disease are at enhanced risk for poor outcomes related to VTE, right? So this again steps into this idea that my default is we need to be coming with, you know, I'm coming at you with the default of we're going to be treating for VTE. We need to be aggressive. We need to be dosed appropriately and based on the trial data because we know that the risk of a poor outcome is greater. So in this study, in the JAMA Open Network, when you look at these Kaplan-Meier curves, the primary outcomes were all-cause mortality, recurrent VTE, and major bleeding. And you see that patients with moderate to severe CKD really experienced worse outcomes with respect to all of those. So we know that from what we've kind of talked about in the literature with the AFib, right? This is, again, coming back. How are we going to be using these DOACs? This is really what I'm coming with at first line now for treating these. But again, it's the dosing. Again, this is what's really critical in using this. So, you know, in my field, when I'm dealing with a lot of patients, you know, the majority of my patients are really CKD 4 and 5. This is really where we have to dig in and look at these details. And again, this comes back to probably the use of apixaban or, as we mentioned, the use of rivaroxaban. Again, the rivaroxaban and CKD4, I'm dosing at 15 milligrams once daily. That's based on the pharmacokinetic data and the FDA insert there. And again, the apixaban, we're dosing based on CKD4. This is for VTE now. We're talking about either 2.5 milligrams twice a day or for patients with more preserved renal function, 5 milligrams twice daily. I myself just because of my patient population, I almost have never written or used a doxaban or dabigatran personally. But that's obviously quite a selection bias as a nephrologist.
It's understandable. And I can imagine for VT, that's fair. And with the cumulative incidence of events these people have, that's really valuable. Tell me a little bit about de-escalation, John. Do you stop therapy? When do you stop therapy? How do you do that?
Yeah, thanks, Manesh. That's an interesting question and an important question when it comes to de-escalation therapy. There's always this question when we start therapy, and certainly as we're going along, one of the first things the patients are going to ask is, when do we stop? And how long do I need to go on this? And obviously, this is going to come back to, again, shared decision-making in a lot of ways. A lot of our patients live in chronic inflammatory states by the very definition of having chronic kidney disease, and of course, the things that lead to chronic kidney disease. So for most of my patients, I'm not going to say I'm going to see you in 12 months. Good luck. Right. I'm going to say we're starting therapy here. I'm going to see you in 3 months. We're going to really reassess. How's it gone? How are you tolerating the medication? Have you had any major adverse effects related to the medication or compliance issues? And at the 3 month mark, we're going to reassess that. And typically if they're doing pretty well, depending on the event, I would probably push them onwards to about 6 months of therapy, and then we're really going to have a conversation. What are the underlying factors that drove you to have this VTE-related event, right? And, of course, your baseline risk for VTE in the future has now gone up. It doesn't guarantee that you're going to have another venous thromboembolism, right? But you're certainly at enhanced risk. So sometimes it'll be, I had an interesting conversation with a patient, said, well, you're at enhanced risk, but this doesn't guarantee you're having another DVT in the future. But if you're in a high-risk situation on top of this, then we may want to think about, okay, if you're taking a long plane ride, if you become pregnant, if you develop some type of other enhancing risk factor, then maybe we do want to anticoagulate for a period of time. That's kind of how my conversation goes with them. I don't know how you treat de-escalation.
Well, I think you're right. I think these turn into, you know, the biggest factors I can think of, as you just highlighted, are, you know, I don't want to say clot burden, but clot risk. When they have VTE, what was the underlying cause? Was there a recurrent reason? Cancer is one example. Recurrent DVT or VTE. Large pulmonary embolism sometimes gets treated longer, I think, in the patient risk factors that we're thinking about. And then finally, as you said, provocation. And that's a spectrum. You know, how much was this one? You know, is a young person who had a knee operation after a ski accident, well, that may not be as long-standing, versus an older person who's had a chronic medical illness and has been in the hospital. So each patient does require a little, I think, standard or at least our own specific space there. I guess the last question I had for you, John, before we get into some shared decision-making is, tell me a little bit about calciphylaxis and how big an issue is. You know, most of our non-nephrology colleagues probably don't think about it that much, see it that much, or associate it with warfarin. So give me a little bit of your sort of take on calciphylaxis and what you've seen with it and what you think of it.
Yeah, absolutely. This is an incredibly important topic and one that's probably not fully appreciated by people outside of nephrology. Although it's a relatively rare condition, calciphylaxis or calcific uremic arteriolopathy is an incredibly fatal and highly morbid condition that arises not exclusively, but almost exclusively in patients with advanced stage kidney disease and those on dialysis. I see probably about, honestly, I probably see 5 to 10 cases a year of calciphylaxis. The majority of these have been in patients not only with kidney disease, but who also have been on or are on warfarin. And we know that for whatever reason, the etiology and the pathogenesis of calciphylaxis is intimately related to dysregulation in the vitamin K pathways. And so warfarin in this uremic milieu that our patients live in really enhances the risk factors for chronic kidney disease. It's an incredibly difficult condition to treat. The wounds progress very rapidly and they're very painful. And of the, let's say, 10 patients I see a year, probably 9 out of 10 end up dying from the calciphylaxis, and that's from the overwhelming infection or the cardiovascular, just the incredible cardiovascular mortality. And I'll even note that in patients that don't have, quote-unquote, full-on calciphylaxis, there's still no doubt, Manesh, that in our population on dialysis, we see in a lot of our patients this really accelerated calcification of the vascular system. So we had a patient, this has just happened in the last month, that she started dialysis 4 or 5 years ago, and you look back at her CT scans, you say, there's really not much there. And now she's getting CT scans for other reasons, and you're seeing this calcification everywhere. And this is really what scares me about not only our dialysis population, but the warfarin in our ESRD or dialysis population, in addition to just how difficult it is to dose.
Right? Yeah, no question. Actually, as we know, there's a biologic pathway by which warfarin and vitamin K antagonists are likely through some other oxidation pathways affecting calcification in the vessels. And it is a very difficult problem to manage. But even short of calciphylaxis, it's probably accelerating calcification.
I think, yes, no doubt about it. I believe that to be the case. And,
well, this is really a great conversation. Maybe we end by talking about our third objective, which is maybe the most important in medicine that we can think of these days, but it's sometimes the hardest to do, which is to think about how do we apply the data we just talked about and convey that in a way that is patient-centric to allow shared decision-making to both improve long-term outcomes for our patients, but really adherence to those therapies. And John, maybe I'll start by just mentioning one definition that people don't often think about, although I think in this day and age, hopefully more and more people are thinking about it, which is the definition of just implicit bias. And just thinking about the bias we may all have, which is an automatic reaction we may have towards other people. We may not even know that we have it. We just walk in the room sometimes. We may have stereotypes or understanding or actions that might affect our decision-making. And one of the reasons to think about standard practice or processes is the idea that these biases, prejudices we may have, we may not even believe them to exist, but when we're seeing patients, we may be unintentionally, or as some have said, implicitly, looking and leading to disparities in care. And that becomes really important. And for those that are out there looking to see how do they do, what are the things which might help you understand your own implicit potential bias, there is a project called Project Implicit. You can look up the website and take a test to see where your blind spots might be or spots that you are actually not paying attention to. I think that's really critical. And then I guess, John, what I think about when I think about shared decision-making, I'll be interested in what yours is. I actually think of it almost like a transference. I am going to try to make sure my patient can understand the medical condition, VTE or AFib, and understand some of the consequences of that. So I'm sharing knowledge and the best I can. Hopefully they can understand it. Often asking them, repeat it back, understand, make sure they do a little testing to say, so are there questions about what does a stroke mean or bleeding and what are those efforts, things like that. But then we elicit their preferences, as you highlighted earlier in your conference. This is what I really care about. This is what a high quality day looks like for me. This is what I want my care to be. And then together we come up with a shared decision making to try to mesh their quality of life goals with our management of their condition. Is that fair? And is that how you see the process? And then maybe we talk about just a moment about some of the things that we might think about when we're doing this.
Yeah, I think absolutely. I mean, it's a two-way street, right? And I think first and foremost, our job as physicians is to communicate, right? And we have to be able to communicate complex, vast amounts of data in a way that the patient can interpret. And then we need to be able to listen, right, to kind of hear what they're saying back to us so that we then come to some mutual agreement. So I think it's important not to walk in with these dogmatic notions about what is and isn't correct or right, but really to walk in an open listening frame of mind, which is easier said than done in our rushed world of clinic patients and RVUs and, you know, trying to turn over volume. But to really, you know, sit down and take 5 minutes, 5-10 minutes, who doesn't have that, right? And walk through this. And I try to present data, right, that's understandable. Talk about the trials. Talk about why it is. What's the what I would call the pillars of therapy, right, that we talk about. And also, like you mentioned, trying to recognize your blind spots or where your implicit biases may be. And that takes a lot of self-reflection. And I would add that, obviously, gender and race and ethnicities play a large role. And I would add that age is a big one, right, that we talked about. We touched on this a little bit, right, that these are patients that are older. Maybe they don't need the antiplatelets. Maybe they're going to fall, right? And we used to do this with blood pressure until Sprint came along, and it told us that we were completely wrong. These are patients that benefit the most with aggressive blood pressure lowering. So our biases were really playing into the way we were treating the population.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that gets into whether they have VTE or AFib, when they are older or they have renal disease, we may have these biases about their comorbidities and whether they can benefit. And so I think having the conversation, in addition to I'll call the generally recognized social determinants of health, which include race and ethnicity, social network, health literacy, a neighborhood or rural area, financial resources, food insecurity, opportunity for housing, a variety of things that probably play a role in everyone's ability to getting access to equitable health. And obviously our role is to try to make sure that we're educating our colleagues, we're making sure that all of our patients get opportunities to have the conversation, and that they hopefully can get therapy when they at least have the opportunity to think about it. Well, we're just about out of time. So by way of summary, I'd like to offer just a few, what I'll call, you know, people often speak of them as SMART goals, specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely action items that hopefully you can take back to your practice. You know, in your patients with AFib and VTE, assess all of those patients for their risk of actually having thrombotic events. So the VTE patients have already had one. The atrial fibrillation patients might be at risk for stroke. So assessing those patients for that risk is important. You might follow that by assessing their bleeding risk to see, are they at high rates of bleeding? And I would argue that for most of these patients, your default is going to be to treat them and to implement anticoagulation while considering their renal impairment, but also considering the correct dose. And then finally, hopefully doing a shared decision-making model where you can make sure that they're engaged appropriately, hopefully have asked the opportunity to ask questions, and their preferences are being identified as you think about the therapy, so that you can remove any barriers, whether they're social determinants barriers like health literacy, but also considering access to therapy and things like that. Anyway, thank you all for joining this course on the Balancing Act, optimizing anticoagulation care in our renally impaired patients with non-valvular atrial fibrillation and venous thromboembolism. I'd like to thank you, John, for joining me for an insightful discussion. It's fun, as always. Thank you all as the audience for joining us. I hope this information will be helpful to you in your own practice, and please use all of the resources we've tried to highlight during this course.